Hello, everyone. This is Bill Vondahar with another edition of Moments in History. History Magazine, August-September 2019, has a couple different articles that we're going to be reading about. The first one is by David Crew, who looks at the remarkable life and sudden death of the man who brought many improvements to radio. It's entitled, A Death in New York City. It begins, nobody saw the body as it fell from the 13th floor window of a New York City high-rise. Nobody heard the thump of it hitting the third floor balcony. The man's body, crumpled, broken, and fully clothed, was found the next morning by the maintenance man. He was a pitiful sight, as the dead man was dressed in a fine overcoat, hat, and gloves. The police were called, and the worker identified the deceased as a resident of the building. Up in his apartment, the police saw no sign of a struggle. In fact, except for the air conditioning unit lying on the floor near an open window, nothing looked suspicious. Then they found the note. The next morning, a New York Times article on the suicide included the contents of a two-page note the deceased had written to his wife. Just a few days earlier, she had left him after a physical altercation. The Times reported that he had written, he was heartbroken at being unable to see her once again and expressing deep regret at having hurt her, the dearest thing in his life. The note concluded, God keep you and Lord have mercy on my soul. It was dated January 31, 1954 and had written just before he killed himself. Edwin Howard Armstrong, one of the pioneers of radio, was dead. If you're like most people, you've probably never heard of Edwin Armstrong. When you think of radio, you doubtless think of Marconi. But it was Armstrong who made a series of discoveries and inventions that led to the modern AM radio receiver, FM radio, and Doppler radar. Few individuals who came before or after him were as honored as Armstrong by the broadcasting community. He was a recipient of the Medal of Honor from the Institute of Radio Engineers, the French Legion of Honor, and the 1942 Edison Medal, among other awards. After his passing, accolades poured in from the scientific and business world. No words were more telling about Armstrong's tormented life and legacy than those of RCA President David Sarnoff to his biographer, Carl Dreher. I did not kill Armstrong, he said. What a strange answer to a question that nobody asked. Then again, maybe not, given the long and litigious history between the two men and the well-known effect those court battles had on Armstrong. To properly tell the story of his death requires that we go back to the very early days of radio, long before it was a business, when it was still the domain of experimenters. Like the early days of home computers, it was a time when inquisitive young men and women tested and tinkered with things that most considered mere toys, and even fewer considered had the potential to be a profitable business. That began to change in 1906 when Lee DeForest's invention of the Audion tube, the first electronic device to amplify a signal. Even though it didn't amplify signals by much, and the signal it produced was not very clean, it was still a major breakthrough. DeForest tried to improve the Audion, but like most other experimenters, he really didn't understand how the device he built actually worked. Edwin Armstrong was among those who tinkered with the Audion, and he was equally frustrated over its poor performance. Notwithstanding how the tube worked or why it didn't perform better was not in Armstrong's nature. In 1912, when still an undergraduate at Columbia University, Armstrong, working with Professor Joseph Moorcroft, discovered the principle of regeneration, also known as positive feedback. By employing regeneration to a newer generation of Audion tubes, Armstrong created a circuit with amplification hundreds of times greater than before. Further tinkering with the regenerating circuit led to the discovery of how to generate a continuous wave, CW, signal. This was hugely important because, up until this time, radio operators used spark gap, which required massive amounts of power to generate a signal. Limited to low frequencies, near today's AM radio band, spark gap signals had limited range. CW, or continuous wave, on the other hand, could broadcast at higher frequencies. There the signals could bounce around the ionosphere, thus enabling worldwide radio communication. Fewer discoveries were as game-changing, not just for radio, but for society at large. Armstrong was granted a patent for regeneration in 1914. Armstrong wasn't done. Just 5 years later, after serving in Europe during the war, where as a member of the Signal Corps he improved wireless communication for the Allies, he filed a patent for another groundbreaking invention, the supersonic or super heterodyne receiver. It is at this point that we start to run out of superlatives to describe the impact of Armstrong's inventions on communication. Perhaps the best way to describe the importance of the super heterodyne circuit is to say that it is still used today in most radio designs. Imagine, with all the breakthroughs made in electronics since then, that the preferred method of radio receiver design is still based on a 100-year-old blueprint. But jealous eyes were cast on Armstrong soon after he was granted his patent for the regenerative circuit in 1914. Lee DeForest, who had been publicly skeptical about Armstrong's findings, filed a competing and strikingly similar patent application. This triggered a hearing at the patent office that included two other claimants to the profits from the regenerative circuit. Our story now veers from the technical aspect to the legal, two areas with equally dense and arcane rules. One such rule was that Armstrong, who needed money to pay for the lawyers, could sell the rights to the circuit in dispute, the caveat being that he could only sell to amateurs and experimenters and not to any commercial concern. Armstrong would double down in his fight for the rights when he countersued DeForest for infringement. Armstrong won. At this point, one might expect that he would be satisfied and move on. But believing that the compensation board's award was not enough, Armstrong returned to court to press for more money. DeForest, feeling cornered, appealed the patent office decision in a higher court. Armstrong and the engineering community at large were shocked when the District of Columbia Court ruled in DeForest's favor. Furious, Armstrong began a series of appeals which his higher courts also ruled against him, wound up twice before the Supreme Court, and he lost both times. The stress and cost of one such legal battle would be enough for anyone. Yet, during the same period, Armstrong was also battling Frenchman Lucien Levy for the rights to the super heterodyne receiver. Levy had been awarded patents in France for a similar, but not exact, design as early as 1917. AT&T, looking to use radio in support of their existing landline network, had purchased the U.S. rights to Levy's patent and now challenged Armstrong's claim to the super heterodyne circuit. Armstrong, already consumed with his fight against DeForest over regeneration, would concurrently be on the defense over the super heterodyne. In 1928, to Armstrong's dismay, the D.C. Court of Appeals found in Levy's favor and stripped Armstrong of his legal claim to the super heterodyne circuit. Misery, so the actual quote from Shakespeare's The Tempest goes, acquaints a man with strange bedfellows. Apparently so does the law. Even though he was embroiled in a legal battle with Levy over super heterodyne, Armstrong could still work on improvements to the circuit. The catch? He could only do so as an employee of David Sarnoff's Radio Corporation of America, RCA, whom he was suing over the regeneration circuit. Strange bedfellows indeed. Working with other engineers at RCA, Armstrong ultimately delivered a less expensive and super heterodyne circuit than the one designed by Levy. RCA would use it in a new line that they called Radiola, which became the company's first big seller. One might expect that the success of the Radiola line would signal a reapproachment between Armstrong and Sarnoff. It did begin that way. In 1921, Armstrong developed something he called super regeneration, which basically was regeneration on steroids. Armstrong, in another legal quirk, was able to sell the rights to super regeneration to RCA, even though he was mired in the legal battle with DeForest. Sarnoff was more than grateful to Armstrong, giving the inventor $200,000 and 60,000 shares of stock in RCA, making the young inventor the biggest stockholder in Sarnoff's company. Imagine giving a bonus to an employee who is suing your company. So what happened to sour the relationship between Armstrong and Sarnoff? Well, from the very beginning, AM radio was bedeviled by the problems of static and noise from lightning and electrical equipment. Nobody, not even Armstrong, could eliminate the problem. The public, having no alternative, was willing to put up with occasional static from the radios. Armstrong was not willing to. He threw himself into the problem. In 1933, after years of work in a secret laboratory at Columbia, Armstrong was granted a patent for another groundbreaking achievement. It was a method of modulation for delivering high-fidelity audio broadcasts called frequency modulation, or FM. Armstrong was contractually obligated to offer the rights to RCA. David Sarnoff turned it down, preferring to stake his company's future on television. Armstrong, freed from the obligation to RCA, partnered with some of the other competitors, including radio giants Zenith and General Electric, to continue his research. Just 3 years later, in 1936, at a demonstration of FM radio at FCC headquarters in Washington, D.C., it was reported that if the audience of 500 engineers had shut their eyes, they would have believed the jazz band was in the same room. There was no extraneous sounds. Several engineers after the demonstration that they considered Dr. Armstrong's invention was one of the most important radio developments since the first earphone crystal sets were introduced. This was just the first of several triumphant demonstrations of Armstrong's FM. In 1940, General Electric set up a dramatic demonstration of FM's ability to provide static-free listening. Next to the receiver, they placed a Van de Graaff generator, which produced 1 million volt arcs of interference. When set to test an AM station, the radio blared nothing but static. Switched to FM, there was no static at all. Impressed, the FCC established the frequency band 42 to 50 megahertz for FM, beginning on January 1, 1941. Unfortunately for Armstrong and FM, the December 7th attack on the United States put their research on hold. The country needed all of its resources fighting the Second World War. After the war, Armstrong expected to pick up where he had been left off. But his dream for FM was shattered when the FCC unexpectedly moved the band up to 88 to 108 megahertz, where it is located today. The commission cited the 42 to 50 megahertz band susceptibility interference from atmospheric skip, which they said neutered the advantages of FM. Broadcasters had until January 8, 1949 to make the switch, which rendered the 400,000 receivers sold since 1941 obsolete. Armstrong, still smarting from his legal defeats over regeneration and super heterodyne, suspected that the decision to change the frequency of the FM band was nothing less than a conspiracy between Sarnoff and AM station owners to render his FM receivers obsolete. His paranoia heightened when shortly thereafter, the FCC assigned the original FM band, 42 to 50 megahertz, to television. This is the ill-fated Channel 1, soon abandoned because viewers found the effects of Skip on reception made it unwatchable. Ironically, the FCC was right about Skip. A good portion of the band was handed over to amateur radio. Hams loved Skip for the very unpredictability that doomed the band for commercial use. Armstrong's feelings of persecution were reinforced when Sarnoff, who had tossed aside FM in favor of television before the war, now put his engineers to work on RCA's own version of FM. Sarnoff then convinced his competitors to stop paying for the rights to use Armstrong's FM patent and to use RCA's instead. A furious Armstrong sued, but ran out of money when the patent for his version of FM expired in 1950. His financial troubles and mental health both spiraled downward. 4 years later, he was dead. After Armstrong's suicide, his widow, Marion, pressed on with his lawsuit against RCA. Perhaps due to the bad publicity from the inventor's very public suicide, RCA settled out of court with Marion for $1 million. Ironically, that was the exact amount Sarnoff offered Armstrong for his rights to his version of FM back in 1940. Marion also sued several manufacturers she claimed were infringing on her husband's FM patent. In 1967, she won the last of those suits, which established Edward Howard Armstrong as the inventor of FM. Until her death in 1979, Marion devoted herself to overseeing a research foundation named for her husband. It is a final irony of Edward Armstrong's life that back in the 1920s, Marion had been David Sarnoff's secretary. It was there at the offices of RCA where Armstrong first became smitten with the woman who would become his wife, the woman who would later win the fight against Sarnoff, her former boss. And that's the end of the story. It's entitled A Death in New York City. David Crewe looks at the remarkable life and sudden death of the man who brought many improvements to radio. That was in the History Magazine, August-September 2019. We have another article, more of a lighthearted and somewhat fun article in the same magazine. And it's written by Brian D'Ambrosio, who looks at how a young woman from Alabama would become known as the world's greatest woman pilot. It's entitled International Champion Aviatrix, The Life of Catherine Stinson. It begins. Years between Orville and Wilbur Wright's first successful airplane flight in 1903 and the United States' entry into World War I in 1917 were rousing times for the early aviation industry. Flying was still a novelty, more or less a sport. Enthusiastic crowds gathered at air shows across the nation to see if the odd motor-powered flying machines could get off the ground and stay off the ground. Onlookers admired anyone brave enough to sit in one of these delicate-looking open-air planes and try to fly it into the air. The early pilots were as popular as movie stars or sports heroes. Few men were audacious enough to try flying. It was virtually unheard of for a woman to take to the air in a plane. Young Catherine Stinson did, and some people called her the world's greatest woman pilot. Born in Fort Payne, Alabama, in 1891, she had no plans to become the world's greatest woman pilot. Originally, all Stinson wanted was to go to Europe to study music and to come back to America to become a great piano teacher. However, the 19-year-old had to earn money to pay for her trip to Europe, and after reading newspaper accounts about the daredevil and pioneer pilots who flew over vacant fields across America, some of whom earned as much as $1,000 a day, she had an idea. She would convince her parents that she would earn a pilot's license and put on her own air shows. My father didn't approve in the least, Stinson sold a newspaper in 1915. He was like a hen with an unmanageable duckling in his brood. But I finally gained the consent of both parents, and I set out to be an aviator as a means of becoming a music teacher. When she took a hot air balloon ride with friends in Kansas City in 1911, Stinson found out that riding in the sky was exhilarating. She got her first chance to ride in an airplane in 1912. But who would teach a young girl to fly? There were fewer than 200 licensed pilots in the whole world at that time, only three of whom were women. She sought out the tutelage of one of the most respected early aviators, Max Lilly of Chicago. At first, Lilly, after sizing up the small, a little over 5 feet tall, and light, only about 101 pounds girl, he flat out refused. Yet only after 4 hours of flight time with Max Lilly, Catherine flew alone. On July 24, 1912, she passed a test to earn her pilot's license and became the fourth licensed woman pilot in America. She began her aviation career 11 years before Charles Lindbergh took his first flying lesson, and 16 years before Amelia Earhart became the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic. Stinson flew in air shows at county and state fairs everywhere, in Ohio, Georgia, Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana, and hundreds of other places. In 1913, Catherine's mother, Emma Stinson, joined Catherine in founding the Stinson Aviation Company in Hot Springs, Arkansas, the family's current home. They began to build, sell, and rent aircraft. Stinson kept an eye on the construction of airplanes she had specifically designed for long-distance flights. Some of the male pilots teased her because she went over every inch of her plane, scrubbing and polishing the wires and cleaning the joints. Stinson wrote in the American magazine in 1917, she wrote, "The men thought I was a regular old maid about it. They said I would ruin the cloth by scrubbing and that the oil didn't hurt the wires and joints anyway. But I wanted to see the condition of things under all that dirt. And I really did find that a good many wires needed to be replaced. It's all right if your automobile goes wrong when you are driving it. You can get out on the road and tinker with it. But if your airplane breaks down, you can't sit on a convenient cloud and tinker with it." Thousands of people watched Catherine Stinson perform daring stunt flights in several different biplanes. Stinson fan clubs sprang up around the world. Stinson established speed, distance, and endurance records, and she helped the early aviation industry gain public acceptance and popularity. In Los Angeles, California, in 1915, Stinson spelled out CAL, C-A-L, with fireworks, becoming the first pilot to do night skywriting. In London, Stinson startled the conservative English, who looked up in the sky and saw her plane sailing around the Houses of Parliament and the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral. In 1916, when Stinson toured Japan and China, she was the first woman to fly in those nations. Nearly 25,000 people turned out to see her Tokyo performance in December 1916. She flew for 15 minutes and traced the letter S in the sky with fireworks. The people of Japan overwhelmed her with tributes, calling her the Air Queen. In China, she made 32 flights, including a private expedition for the Chinese leaders. When the United States entered World War I, Stinson volunteered to help her country, but because she was a woman, the Army turned her down. In the summer of 1917, however, she volunteered by dropping Red Cross fundraising leaflets, flying from Buffalo, New York, to Washington, D.C. Also that year, she set a major aviation record, flying 610 miles from San Diego to San Francisco, farther than any pilot have ever flown without stopping. She even became an expert ambulance driver in World War I, serving in London and France, driving wounded soldiers to safety. One day in May 1918, she set out to fly the mail nonstop from Chicago to New York, a record distance. But she ran into some wind-related difficulty and landed on a hill in the mud near Binghamton, New York. The shortened flight of 783 miles broke her own long-distance record. At the end of World War I, she contracted influenza, which was later diagnosed as tuberculosis. She fought a six-year battle to recover from the disease. The treatment was rest and withdrawal from her previously active life. She moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and in 1928 she married Miguel Otero, Jr., a former World War I airman. She studied architecture and became an award-winning home designer. Catherine Stinson's younger sister, Marjorie, 1896-1975, was well known in aviation circles also, earning her pilot's license in 1914 when she was only 18 years old. Catherine Stinson lived to be 86 years old. In an interview that she granted towards the end of her life, she described fear as either a lack of self-confidence or an absence of self-knowledge. She said, "If you are afraid of what you don't understand, of the things you cannot account for, you are afraid to attempt something you believe that you cannot do." And that's the end of the article written by Brian D'Ambrosio, entitled "International Champion Aviatrix, The Life of Catherine Stinson." The article looks at how a young woman from Alabama would become known as the world's greatest woman pilot. And that was in the August and September edition of 2019 edition of the History Magazine. We appreciate you listening, and I think that's all we have for you today during this session. But continue to listen, and in future we will have other interesting articles. This is Bill Vondahar with Moments in History. Thank you.